I'm Marty Moscawen. Welcome back to Radio Times. A study by Merrill Lynch found that two-thirds of people 50 years and older are financially helping their adult children, their grandchildren, their parents, their in-laws, and siblings. And the overwhelming reason? It's the right thing to do. It's relatively easy to manage how much one's child receives for their allowance when they're 10 years old. But what, if anything, are they owed when they are adults with student loans and rent and mortgage payments and bills? And what about lending money to your parents or your sibling? Families and money can be really messy. It's a potential minefield, and it's our show today on Radio Times. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Ellen Berman. She's a family psychiatrist and clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, also the founder of the Center for Couples and Adult Families at the Perelman School of Medicine's Department of Psychiatry. She trains psychiatric residents at Penn, and she's been in private practice for over 30 years in Marion. And Ellen Berman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. And also with us is Ron Lieber. He writes the Your Money column for the New York Times. He's the author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. And Ron Lieber, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be back. Thanks.
Nice to have you back. And Ron, let me begin with you, but Ellen, I want to have you weigh in as well. Ron, I remember you being on the show. We were talking largely about young children. Is when children are young, is that the time to raise the groundwork for the kind of financial relationship you have with them when they grow up?
Absolutely. Look, I think it starts as early as age two or three when they start to ask questions about money. You know, quite often grown-ups silence kids. They say, you know, this is none of your business if they're asking about the family financial matters. But the fact of the matter is it is their business. And, you know, the revenues and the expenses of the family, it matters to them. And it will matter more and more as they grow up and grow more sophisticated. So we want to be talking to them and preparing them to make ever bigger financial decisions all along the way. And I think the more we do that, the better chance we have that they are prepared to be independent sooner rather than later.
Ellen, we know that partners often will argue or have conflicts over money. Then you throw in the adult children. Just how fraught is this when it comes to adult children and their families?
Well, I think it really depends on the family because, first of all, money is all about values. Once you've gotten past a roof over your head and food, after that, it depends on what the family thinks about money and what's important. And the thing I want to say about small children, which continues in large children,
yes, it does,
is, you know, as wonderful as that book is, and I love your book about talking
this
to kids
to you,
about
Ron
money.
Yes,
that was to you, Ron.
Thank you.
It is also true that kids are watching all the time, and whether you talk about money or not, they are getting very clear messages from listening to the adults' arguments, from seeing how their friends live, from trying to figure out how to scramble and seeing themselves as victims or survivors, so that by the time kids are adults, they have a lot of very strong beliefs and feelings about money, about whether they're owed money or not, about what money should be used for. And very often it's those things learned in childhood and those arguments from childhood that get continued in adulthood.
Plus, as you were saying, these are children, of course, who watch their parents very carefully. So they see how their parents, maybe one parent spending money one way, another parent spending another way, perhaps some different kinds of values that they're learning from the grown-ups in their lives.
That's right. And which parent they feel more loyal to, which parent they feel more right, will very much affect who they are. And very often, as parents argue, is one gets tougher, the other one gets easier. So you get this bad seesaw, which ends up as good cop, bad cop. And rather than the parents coming together around their values and beliefs, and kids deal with that in a lot of difficult and complicated ways.
I wonder, Ron, too, whether we have a belief, whether it's true or not, that, you know, once you become an adult, then you become this independent person and you should be able to take care of yourself. Now, we know with the recession and the fallout from the recession, that's been harder for some than in others. But do you think that's a kind of a belief system?
Well, it's been fascinating to see what has essentially been a sort of revolution culturally in the way that we feel about this, just in a generation. you know, as recently as 30 or 40 years ago, we expected people to be financially independent, not when they were 22, but when they were 18. You could go to your flagship state university. You could work your way through. You could even save money along the way. And by the time you were 22, you were on your own. Now, if you were lucky enough to come from an affluent family that would help you out with a down payment or graduate school, great. But that wasn't an expectation. And now we've got, you know, Merrill Lynch running these polls saying that people feel like it's the right thing to do to help their adult children. And that wasn't something that we believed until very recently.
I mean, picking up on that, Ellen, probably it's the right thing for some adult children, but perhaps the wrong thing for other adult children. What's the difference there? How does a parent decide?
Let me say that there are a number of other cultural shifts we need to talk about. One is people were assumed to be settled and married by 22. And so you picked the job and you stayed in that job till you retired. We now have an additional 10 to 20 years of our lifespan. Most of the kids are not married till 30. And so the 20s are a period of exploration. And of course, we also know about the recession and how much harder it is to get a job if you don't have a college degree and more. So I think the issue for right thing, wrong thing is whether, first of all, you have the money to take care of your kids without hurting your own retirement.
And that's very important.
Which is very important. And second of all, I think whether you believe that the kids are working in the right direction or not. You know, you can't support yourself through med school by working anymore. If you're going to go to professional school, your parents are going to have to help out, or their loans are going to be huge. So a lot of it is whether the parents have the money.
Yeah.
And the other piece, I think, which does not happen in childhood, is whether the parents believe that the child is working toward a goal.
Well, let me pick up on both those things. And Ron, let me toss that back to you, which is, I guess, deciding whether a child is the right, investment for a parent is looking at their track record. Have they been responsible, perhaps, through their teenage years into their adult years? What are some of the other criteria?
Well, it's important here to step back and remind ourselves of one thing that hasn't changed. The point of the exercise here as a parent is that you want to raise a fully functioning, fully formed adult, an adult who is financially independent. And so the question you have to ask yourself when you're tempted to help or they ask you for help at 22 or 27 or 36 is, how close are they right now? Why exactly are they asking? Are you helping them to save for retirement now because you know they're going to have that extra 10 or 20 years of lifespan that maybe you didn't have or won't have? Do you understand that it's important, you know, for them to get started at the age of 22 or to get started on, you know, building equity of a place of their own and they're fully employed? And, you know, are you honest with yourself about the fact that, and do you, you know, level with yourself and with them about the fact that they do not deserve to live like you do or in the manner that they have become accustomed as teenagers or college students. I mean, the best way to learn the power of money quite often is through deprivation, through scarcity.
So you don't have that big flat screen TV. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about, Ron?
I think you want to keep a careful eye on what they're spending money on before you agree to help them. I mean, again, part of the point here is that we're trying to teach them to be fully functioning and independent and to understand the difference between wants and needs. And if they want our help, we have the right and I think the obligation to help them come to grips with the fact that they may not be spending their money in the most appropriate fashion.
Ellen, what should that conversation sound like then?
Well, let me just add one thing, since I'm a family psychiatrist, that when you have a kid who has a depression, a mental illness, ADD very often delays maturation for a couple of years, then the question for the parents become, how much do I really have to help because this kid needs some extra time to mature and deal with whatever they're dealing with? How you have the conversation with a child, I think, depends mostly on the kinds of conversations that you've had in the past. These are highly emotional issues. The kids already know what your values are. But I think that really depends very much on the issue of the conversation. And if parents and kids have been able to talk to each other calmly in whatever way, it will generally go well. And if this is the end product of a long series of arguments, then you may need some professional help of some kind.
Well, let me pick up something that was mentioned earlier. I'll toss this back to you, Ellen, which is that there are certainly plenty of families and, let's say, parents or partners who are struggling financially. They may want to help their children. They may, you know, have a great desire to do that, but they cannot afford to do that. And perhaps they feel badly about that. How should we understand those parents?
I think that if they've raised the kinds of children that he's talking about, you know, where they've had conversations and the kids know what the situation is, then the issue is, I wish I could help. Is there some other way I could help? And certainly parents have other ways to help besides money, often having the kids live at home, which is what a lot of adult children are doing, or child care, so that they don't, if they're married and have kids, they don't have to put the kids in daycare, which costs a lot of money. I think there are many ways to help besides giving money. And I think that's really important. If you don't have it, you don't have it.
Ron, we're almost having a break here. Just a quick question. If an adult child is living with their parents, do you think the parents should charge them rent, room and board?
Well, I think it depends on why they're there in the first place. Did they come and approach the parent and say, I want to do this because I'm saving for a down payment and I'm saving for a security deposit and I'm saving for graduate school, then maybe you cut them a break. But if it's a child who's having trouble launching, having trouble getting motivated, you know, won't take a bad job because they're holding out for the good job, well, maybe you do charge them rent. Maybe you start below market and you raise it a little bit each month. So after a year or 18 months or whenever you want them out of there, it's above market at that point, and they have an incentive to get their act together and move on.
And that's Ron Lieber. He writes the Your Money column for the New York Times, wrote a book called The Opposite of Spoiled. Also with us is Ellen Berman. She's a family psychiatrist and clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, talking about adult children and the relationship between adult children and their parents. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Ellen, almost up on a break here, but I'd just be curious about the idea of room and board. Does that make sense to you?
I think that there are, once you have a child who's an adult, you are allowed to give money with strings attached if you want. So you can ask for room and board. You can say you can only stay here as long as you're in school. You can make whatever arrangements you think are reasonable. One of the other things I think that's really important is that if a child comes home, that child is not a guest. The child is a family member. So they need to be helping around the house. They need to be offering to make the parents' life easier. And depending on what they're doing, I think they should be paying something. But again, it depends on what the circumstances are.
Well, a very short break. We'll be back to our conversation. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking about money and families. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with psychiatrist Ellen Berman and columnist Ron Lieber about money and families. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Ellen, there's one thing you wanted to make sure we talked about, and it sort of turns what we were just talking about on its head, which is there are circumstances where adult children might be asked or feel compelled to lend money to their parents. Flesh that out for us.
So certainly culturally, there are differences in the way cultures think about kids and whether the parents owe the kids forever or the kids owe the parents something back. In some families where everyone's struggling, everybody helps out and whoever has the most problem gets helped. Unfortunately, there are a lot of families where the parents have really been very sloppy about money. They have gambled, they've had addictions, they have not bothered to save, and they've spent inappropriately. And sometimes they have children who've actually done very well. And the children can lend the parents money, and that's very difficult if those kids were not treated well when they were growing up. because the parents had problems, which is why they didn't save their money in the first place.
Well, and- I mean, should you lend your parents under those circumstances? Should you have the same kind of strings attached, which is, handle this money responsibly? I might be the child, but you're the irresponsible adult.
Well, I think by the time a parent is 60 or 70, there's a limit to how much they are going to change. So I think that the question is, what's the relationship between the adult kids and the parents? What do the kids feel is the right thing to do? And can they stop if the parent keeps asking and say, this is my limit? To help someone who says, this is wonderful, thank you, I've been helped, and can I make you dinner is one thing. To help someone, when you help them, they say, well, that's great, when is the next time you're going to help me?
Yes.
That's where you start thinking about boundaries very carefully and what is possible and what is fair and right.
Ron, you want to weigh in on that, boundaries and money?
Sure. Well, I mean, the first rule of family loans, intra-family loans, is always that you should begin with the assumption that you will never get a cent of it back.
Yep.
And then you have to think about how that's going to feel and how that's going to affect the relationship. That has to be the baseline assumption. There are all sorts of contracts. You can work with third-party companies who will set up intra-family loans, but you have to begin with the assumption that you won't get it back. And then are you going to try and collect? Are you going to take them to court? Probably not, right? So, one thing you might consider is, well, you know, how could I change the sort of baseline arrangements that this troubled parent or family member is operating under? Right. Could I buy their home if I have the means to do so and rent it back to them? Could we do an intra-family reverse mortgage where, you know, they get a credit line that's, you know, funded by me that helps them out? Could I be paying directly for basic living expenses as opposed to handing over cash or a check written out to them that they can then do with what they want, even though they say they're going to do something else with it? There are ways that you can work around this and help them while still remembering in the back of your head that you may never get anything back.
And just the sort of reality check of that, it sounds like, Ron, you're saying is, and this may be all well-intentioned, you may even call it a loan, but when it comes down to it, you're basically giving people money.
I think you have to begin with that assumption.
You agree with that?
I think if you begin with that assumption internally, you will get less disappointed and enraged. But I think the first conversation is to assume that you will get it back or to just give it as a gift. I think there are a lot of people who will make an attempt to pay a loan back, but it certainly allows you to get to Thanksgiving dinner a lot easier if you're not carrying a grudge for a long time. So I'm with you, Ron.
Well, and we know about families, you know, having these conflicts that sometimes started years, decades ago that never go away, having to do with money, loaning money and not getting repaid.
And though, you know, money, as we said, once you've passed safety, is about meaning. So money can be a symbol for love. Money can be a symbol for you went up a social class, you married into money, you made a lot of money, and you owe us. So that I think that these, when you look at these grudges, what you have to say is, what is the meaning of what was given or not given or repaid or not repaid? And yes, they can go on forever because they strike at the issues of loyalty and love that families struggle with.
Ron, this is a really basic question, but I'm thinking about some of these smaller financial interactions. You're out to dinner. It's parents and there's an adult child. The check comes and, you know, who picks up the tab? What are some of the scenarios that you can imagine?
Well, here, I think the first principle is always respect your elders.
Let them pick it up.
Well, if it's going to make them feel good to do it, particularly if it's a special occasion and you know that they are not struggling or it won't be a burden on them, they're not having trouble paying day-to-day expenses, then by all means, let them, express their feelings through this particular largesse at this particular dinner table at this particular restaurant. I think we should let them have that. But if you're in a situation where you know that they are struggling on a day-to-day basis or they have anxiety around money, picking up the tab, if you're able, is a nice thing to do and can provide a momentary experience of feeling that anxiety lift a little bit. So, I'm not sure there's a hard and fast rule exactly, but you know, as with most things in personal finance, it's more personal than
sure.
it is finance, as
sure.
my friend Tim Maurer puts it. So you know, you have to read the situation on the ground and act appropriately in the moment.
What do you think, Ellen?
This is such a wonderful ritual, the time that the child can first pay the check, that mm-hmm. I sort of hate giving that back to the parents. And again, I think it's about meaning. If your child says to you, you have given me so much, it would give me so much pleasure to pick up this check, then the parent feels mm-hmm. like they've done a great job. If this is a power struggle where, you know, the son often is saying, well, you know, I'm richer than you, and that's what it feels like right. to the father, that's a different thing. So I think it's a fun thing to talk about. Can I do this for you? And is it a message of power, or is it a measure of, I love this, and aren't we happy that I can finally pay a check? But certainly if the parents insist, it's not the grounds to fight on.
Well, let me throw something else back at you, Ellen. This has to do with parents. Let's say parents disagree with each other about, you just rolled your eyes at me, they disagree with each other about whether they should give Bill money to put towards a down payment to a house. How do we reconcile that? And Ron, I'll get you to weigh in on that as well.
Well, I think, again, those conflicts are so rooted in what's going on and in a value system about what is important. Do I like this child? Have you gotten into an old good cop, bad cop with one person saying they should be responsible and the other person saying, oh, you know, they're sad or they're ill, or I know they'll do it if we pay for a while. And that argument needs to happen away from the kid. Right. And if you have a good marriage, you can figure out a compromise. And
what if you don't, though?
That's when people often come and see me, because clearly the issue is not just about the house. It's also about the child's position in the family, who is the preferred person. You know, we give the child the money and you're not taking care of me. Is the child more important than me? This gets into the whole range of complex family dynamics.
Ron, you want to weigh in on this? Then we'll get some callers in.
I would just suggest that when you're faced with an ask from a child, one of the best things you can say in that moment is, I don't know. I'm not sure. Uh-huh. I'm going to have to talk to your father or mother about that before we figure it out, but we would like to try and help. And I would add, if you are a single parent or the other parent is not in the picture, that's a perfectly appropriate response too, because it's a big deal to hand out money or loan mm-hmm. money, and you want to do it exactly right. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with pressing the pause button and just thinking about it for a day or two.
And that's Ron Lieber. He writes the Your Money column for the New York Times, wrote a book called The Opposite of Spoiled. In fact, was a guest on Radio Times talking about that book. Also with us is Ellen Berman. She's a family psychiatrist, clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. She also founded the Center for Couples and Adult Families. That's at the Perelman School of Medicine's Department of Psychiatry. And she's been in private practice in suburban Philadelphia, Marion, for more than 30 years, talking about families and money. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Marshall from, looks like, Perkiomenville to join us on the show. And Marshall, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is a specialized kind of problem where we're approaching retirement. My son is approaching 50, but he has come back home from working and has been home now for 6 years, doing more and more and more around the house, and doesn't seem to be inclined to go back to work, which he's perfectly qualified for. It's kind of, and there's a conflict between my wife and I about how to approach this. I'm really concerned about his future more than ours.
Well, Marshall, I'm really glad you called. I'm actually going to start with our psychiatrist here, Ellen Berman. What are your thoughts, Ellen, based on just what Marshall just shared with us?
I'm not exactly sure what you're asking, Marshall. Are you saying what should you do?
Is that what you're asking, Marshall?
I'm having – psychiatrist is a good thing, because I'm having a lot of sleepless nights trying to struggle with this problem, but I seem to be the only one. out of the three of us that recognizes this as a problem.
So there's
in other words, the son is not in, it doesn't seem to have any intention right. of taking care of his own life. He's sort of devoting himself to us, but he's maturing too. He's got a future to think of.
No, I think that's actually quite helpful. Ellen?
Well, I would tend to go with you that if he's capable of working, that allowing him to stay forever is not good because he needs to have a life. I think what I would need to know is what happened to him that he got so discouraged, and why is your wife not worried? Because so I think those are the questions I would ask, that this is a three-person system. And again, I think I know I sound a little like a broken record, but sometimes when something like this comes up, mm-hmm. you really do want to have all three of you see somebody who's an expert in families to say what's going on here, because it sounds like a complicated situation. And certainly a 50-year-old who's staying at home to, and doing nothing but taking care of his parents, he's got another 30, 40 years to live, and that's not a good career path.
You want to weigh in on that, Ron Lieber?
Sure. Well, I think Dr. Berman is right to address the feelings first, but we should also talk practically about the money here, which is the fact that you, the parents, may have another 30 years to live yourselves. And how much money is going to be left if one or both of you need assisted living at or near the end? You know, one part of the conversation with your son may be that, you know, this has nothing to do with not wanting to help you. We may not be able to. And if you are not out there earning and saving for yourself, you're going to have a real problem.
Marshall, thanks for the call, and good luck to you as well. I wonder, to both of you, I'll start with you, Ellen Berman, which is, should adult children know how much their parents make or have in the bank or owe, as we talk about some of these financial issues?
Can I pass that one back to Ron first?
Okay, go ahead, Ron. What's the answer to that?
So I'm all about the transparency, right? I think teenagers, you know, once they're in 11th or 12th grade, you know, have a right to know how much money their parents make. And I think as a, you know, middle-aged person myself with parents who are retired and dealing with their own health issues and anxieties, I want to help, but the best way I can help is if I am starting with the most amount of information that I can gather, and that includes anything and everything involving finances. I just see no practical reason why this stuff should be hidden from immediate family members. It makes things so much more complicated. Now, I get, and Dr. Berman will probably step in and remind us here, that, you know, in addition to money being about values, it's also about feelings of shame and regret and guilt and fear. And, you know, I know we're going to go down those roads, you know, when we lay everything out on the table financially, but it's hard to help without having the basic facts at hand.
What do you think, Ellen Berman?
I think some of it depends on the issue of whether or not help is needed. And I think some people have very strong feelings about privacy. And because this is very often hooked up with issues of generosity, for example, if my kids know exactly how much I make, are they, you know, do I get worried about, are they waiting for me to die? Do they think I should be giving them more money? If my kids are, and I'm talking generally here,
sure.
If you have kids that are functioning and taking care of themselves, and the parents are not at the moment needing help, then I think if you feel like this is something that is private, you can keep it private. I certainly know that if you need help, I think that's got to be out on the table. I talked to a lawyer once, interestingly enough. I mean, I am normally about transparency, but I talked to a lawyer who did a lot of work on wills, and he said, for God's sakes, don't tell your kids what's in your will.
Oh, really?
And he started telling me stories about how the kids started fighting over what was in the will, and it produced these horrible family conflicts that lasted for years that could have been put off a few years. So I would say it's complicated and it all depends. But certainly if you're asking for help, then you got to be out there.
Here's a comment from Linda. Says, we plan to pay for our granddaughter's college education. Do you think we should have a say in where she goes to college and what her major should be? Ron, I'm tossing that to you, and then I'll give Ellen a chance to weigh in.
That's a tough one. The problem with dictating where someone goes to college or what they're going to major in is that you're asking a 16 or a 17 or 18-year-old, you're expecting them to have achieved some measure of certainty when, in fact, you know, what we've learned from the hard science in the last 10 or 20 years is that adolescents are, it extends into your 20s. You're not fully formed as an individual until well after college, which gets to the fact that, you know, it's nuts to send 18-year-olds to college in the first place. That's for another day
show.
And another show.
Yes.
But to expect that an 18-year-old is going to know exactly what they want to do, as opposed to suggesting that they go to a school where they can explore any and all options, I think sets up limits and really expectations that are probably unreasonable.
Ellen, go ahead. We're almost up on a break here.
I think it's a disaster to dictate a major. What I think you ask for is you say, you have to send us your grades. And if your grades aren't good, then we will rediscuss the issue of where going to school.
Well,
but as long as the kid is working and their grades are good and they're not getting drunk and they're not overspending their budget, I think the child's career direction needs to be theirs. You can also add, by the way, if you are going to be an artist, we are not going to support you after college, so you better get used to, you know.
I'm going to pick up on that. Hold on, because we do have to take a very short break. I don't like putting artists in a different different category.
If you're not going into business, please remember that we will not be your bank forever.
Fair enough. That's Ellen Berman. She's a psychiatrist here in the Delaware Valley. Ron Lieber joining us as well. He writes the Your Money column for the New York Times, and we are talking about money and family, specifically focusing on adult children, adult members of the family, and some of the potential pitfalls and possibilities. 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and we are talking about money and families. And again, our guest in our Philadelphia studio is Ellen Berman, family psychiatrist, clinical professor of psychiatry at Penn, founder of the Center for Couples and Adult Families. And Ron Lieber joining us as well. He writes the Your Money column for the New York Times, author of a book called The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. And interestingly, Ellen, during the break, said, let's talk about the good stuff here. And I think that's a very appropriate thing to talk about, because parents and children, in a sense, on the same page on money is, I would think, a really healthy thing, Ellen.
I think it's great. And I think when parents can support their kids and the kids are going in the right direction, it really gives the kids a sense of safety. Even if it's just, I want you to live in a neighborhood that's safe. I mean, when my kids went out in the world, I was thrilled to be able to give them some money just to make sure that they were living in a neighborhood where I wasn't worried about them all the time. And we paid their health insurance because if they had a health problem, you know, until they could support themselves, we knew they were safe. So I think being able to give to a child who's doing, you know, who's on their path, and make their life safer feels great. You know, when you're a parent of a little kid, you can give your kids lots of stuff. But
sure,
when they're grown up, you can give them love, money, and food, and that's about it. So it's good to be able to help sometimes.
Absolutely. I mean, Ron, it is, in a way, investing in one's children as they are on their career, their adult path.
It's true. And let's take a step back here and realize that if you can help at all, even one iota, you are lucky, and luckier than lots of people who don't have the ability, who don't have the spare room, who don't have the spare money. I've written about this issue from time to time over the years in the newspaper. And one of the my most favorite things that anybody has ever said to me about it. It comes from a woman named Adrienne Weiss Harrison, who's a pediatrician in Westchester County outside of New York City and is herself a parent who has dealt with this with young adult children. And she has a mantra, and it goes like this. When you have adult children, you cannot tell them what to do. You can only tell them what you'll pay for. And if they don't need you to pay for it, then you can only hope that they ask for your advice and take it.
And take
it. I thought that was profound.
That's pretty good. Let me see what Eric from Havertown has to say. Eric, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Love the show. And this topic is relevant to me. I'm a 46-year-old man. 3 years ago, simultaneously, I separated from my wife and got laid off from my job.
Oh, too bad.
And moved in with my parents. I used funds from a 401k to support myself and contribute to my parents' bills for a while. But then I went back to school, which my parents helped me with, and they are people of means. But now that I've graduated and I'm looking for a job, they're both in ill health, and I feel somewhat obliged, given what they've done for me, to stay here and help them. Even though I've been with a woman for several years and I would like to get engaged and move on, but I feel kind of conflicted saying to my girlfriend, hey, would you like to move in with me and my parents?
Eric, I hear you. I think we all hear you. And actually, I'm going to toss this first to Ellen Berman. And, you know, it sounds like what we're hearing from Eric is he feels an obligation to his parents, having helped him out. They're now getting on, and he said not in good health. He feels a responsibility to stay. What do you think?
I think, first of all, you need to talk to your parents about it, but I think you need to get on with your life. You had a terrible series of losses. You now have a possibility to get on with your life. And so the question is, can you help your parents without living there? And I think both financially and financially, you can help them. And also, there are many ways to help aging parents to organize their lives to be available without living in the same house.
And you said that they have some means. So they're, I mean, it sounds like they have.
So they have, if they have the means to get help, then there are many ways for you to, I would say there were many ways for you to help them without staying living in their house.
What do you think?
And you need your life back.
Yeah. What do you think, Ron?
Well, I would just ask them point blank, not in a confrontational way, do they actually want your help at this point? Because if they still have means, they may have been quite happy to help you out in your time of need. But they may expect nothing in return now that their time of need has come. In fact, they may be glad that you are ready to move on and perhaps move in with a new significant other. And they may want to use their own money to hire their own people to help them, quite specifically so that you can move out and move on. So it's a conversation worth having.
I mean, what's interesting is you both basically said the same thing. And Ellen, I wonder in these transactions whether we forget to have that kind of basic conversation, which is, well, what would you like? What do you need?
Right. And I think that's been Ron's point as well, that people say, well, what should I do? And they've never asked the other person or had a series of conversations with the other person where they said, this is what I like. What would you like? How can we make this a win-win?
Eric, thanks for the call. Comment from Margaret says, can they talk about blended families who might have different values when it comes to money? And, of course, these would be, I guess, step families or any sort of configuration of families these days. Ellen, does that complicate the money conversation?
Oh, my God, yes. step families take a long time to come together. Pat Papernow says probably 5 or 6 years to have a functioning step family when things are going well. And families come with different values and people come with different levels of finances. And the whole question of how you handle that, what happens if one kid gets more than another, is a process which takes years to deal with.
So don't rush it.
Don't rush it. It takes a long time. There's a wonderful book by Pat Papernow, who I think was may have been on your show.
I think she was.
Called Surviving and Thriving as a Step Family. But these are a series of very, very touchy conversations. And generally trying to push it into an hour rather than mine, yours, and let's figure out a we. If you try to do that too fast, things get very difficult.
What do you think, Ron?
Well, I would suggest that people reframe their expectations entirely. Extended family, blended family, unusual family or not. In a world where it's getting ever harder to save enough for retirements that are getting ever longer, I think it's perfectly reasonable to simply step back and hope that your parent will not need any financial help from you, and that their goal should be to spend everything that they have and leave nothing at all. And so my expectation is that I will not get any inheritance. I've said this to both my mother and my father. I'm part of a blended family now with my father and his new wife. I've made it clear to him that I expect nothing from him. And what I want to do is to make sure that his final years are filled with great experiences, that he's surrounded by family, that he doesn't have to worry about money, that he spends what he needs to, and that he doesn't worry about me. And if my expectations are low, and if my goal is him to have a happy life and us not to need to spend money on him, then I feel like I've won there. And so perhaps we, need to stop thinking about inheritance as something that, we'll all get or that we're perhaps entitled to.
Ron, do you have siblings and do they feel the same way you do?
I have a brother and a sister, and they feel basically the same way. They're all fully functioning adults financially. They're independent. None of us have ever really asked for or needed much from our parents, except for my brother, who did bunk in with my mother when he was in law school. But, beyond that, we haven't asked for much. We don't expect anything. We want them to be happy and to, live out their years comfortably. It's fine with us if there's nothing left at the end. And if your expectations are sort of set appropriately, I think it becomes a little easier not to get offended by whatever the goings on are, with your step parents or step siblings.
I'd be curious what you think about that, Ellen.
I would think your parents are incredibly lucky.
by which you mean this is very unusual.
Yes. What I see, and remember, since I'm a psychiatrist, I see the families that are struggling, so my N is a little different, is step families where the loyalty binds have been very difficult. And so money becomes, who do you love more? Do you love the children of your second marriage more? Do you love your wife's or husband's children more than you love me? So that when there are struggles, it's, the divorce was difficult, you owe me, and I want you to prove that you love me more than other people. And that's when it goes, that's when it goes bad. I totally think that, part of maturity is assuming you're taking care of yourself. When I go around to the residents and say, how do you define being an adult? Being an adult is making your own decisions and supporting yourself. But when you have these difficult loyalty binds, the money becomes a symbol of all sorts of other things rather than a sensible, practical issue about how do we take care of each other.
Let me see what Barb from Mount Airy has to say. Barb, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
What an interesting conversation. And what I love is how your guests are all pointing out it's complicated and it just depends. I have a son in Korea who's married a Korean woman, and they have a savings account for both myself and the wife's parents. Hmm. And I went out there visiting, and I had to fly back early, and the flight was $350 to add to what I had already paid. And my son insisted on paying it, and he took it out of the account that he has for my husband and me. And none of us are struggling. It's just a custom. So it makes you really harken back probably to the days in Korea where if you didn't save for your parents, you know, there's no nursing home. They were going to be living with you. So
no safety net.
A really interesting thing.
That's wonderful.
That's
what
fascinating.
A great story.
Who knew?
Who knew? Exactly. Barb, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Obviously showing Ron how, you know, different cultures, different traditions have different ways of handling money issues.
Yes, and we're lucky because we're very all hardworking, and my parents and my husband's parents both helped us, so we feel like we're going to give back to our kids, and then they're going to give back to their kids, and everybody's going to keep on helping, and it's worked so far.
That's great. That's great. Ron, anything you want to add to that?
Well, the thing that I like about that tradition, whether you believe that it's right or appropriate or not, is that it's upfront and there is no doubt about it. And that is just the way that it is. I have an African-American friend who married into a Korean family, and he knew before he even got engaged that this was going to be the deal. And her parents were going to be their responsibility as they aged and, you know, take it or leave it. Yeah. So there were no surprises. This was all out in the open. This is the way that it is. And there's a lot of transparency there and, you know, a lot to be impressed by when you know exactly what the situation is going to be. You can predict it. You can prepare for it. And there are no surprises.
Right. An email from Karen, I think, taking issue with something that I said. She says, I have difficulty believing that all parents in their 60s and 70s who are needy enough to ask for a loan from their children are irresponsible or wouldn't save when they could. Has your guest never encountered anyone in the retail or service sector who has not made enough money in order to save? And we were really just talking about adult parents who were irresponsible, had gambling debts and things like that. But she's right, Ellen, in that there are so many people that are working poor,
I am sorry. I thought I had said that. There are lots of situations in which everybody needs to help each other because or the parents need help because the world has become a very difficult place. And I think those are easier because it's clear. The values are clear. The issues are clear. Obviously, someone needs help and someone can give help. And families are about loyalty and caring. I think it gets more difficult when either the parents have been irresponsible or they have all the finances have been responsible, but for whatever reason, there were issues in the kid's childhood that have made the relationship very difficult. I've certainly seen kids whose parents, for whatever reason, really neglected them pretty much in childhood, and it is harder to give back when you don't feel you were taken care of. But I have to say there are an enormous number of children who really get past that and who are generous and loving and who see the need and say, I see a need. They're my parents. I love them and I'll take care of them.
Almost out of time here. Ron, I'm also thinking about whether there are gender differences, whether parents, you know, think differently about how their daughter manages her money, how their son manages his money. Have you found that in some of your reporting, your conversations?
Well, I think it's certainly the case with children, so it stands to reason that it extends into adulthood. Parents talk to boys about money more than they talk to girls, except when it comes to philanthropy. When it comes to giving away your money, the parents talk to the girls more. Expectations that result from that is that female teenagers believe that they're going to earn significantly less than male teenagers do, both as starting salaries and mid-career. So, you know, we're setting the table in a way that is ultimately problematic. So, you know, it's something we ought to be watching out for.
Ellen, final word to you.
I think the other issue is that although couples start out very egalitarian, since men, up until the last couple of years at least, and fairly consistently earn more than women, when babies come along, the women are often the ones who cut their careers down, and that's sort of the assumption. I think gender issues are old, and I was taught not to talk about money or think about money because I was a girl, but I really think that's changing, and I think things are moving very quickly. It will be very interesting to see what stays and what leaves. And I certainly agree with what Ron just said as well.
Well, it's been a great conversation. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Ron Lieber, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And he writes the Your Money column for the New York Times, wrote a book called The Opposite of Spoiled. Ellen Berman, thank you very much as well.
That was so fun. It was great to meet you, Ron.
Thanks very much. And she's a family psychiatrist, clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's got a private practice in the Marion section of this region, and she's been doing that for more than 30 years. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. Diana Allen, our intern, Kevin Griffin, our engineer, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.